This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Melinda Pencava. Separated by just 11 miles, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and Duke University have a long history of working together. Faculty share resources, Robertson scholars enjoy academic benefits at both schools, and shared arts and culture experience are there to be had. But there is one place where the two schools are intense rivals, on the basketball court. For over 50 years, the men's teams at Duke and UNC have battled for bragging rights over the other. Students camp out months ahead of time for the best seats at the two regularly scheduled matchups, and fans argue year-round about the superiority of the coaches and players that make up the best rivalry in sports. Art Chansky has covered the UNC-Duke rivalry since he was a student in Chapel Hill in the 1960s, and through his time as sports editor at what was then the Durham Morning Herald. His new book is called Blue Blood, Duke Carolina, Inside the Most Storied Rivalry in College Hoops. And Art Chansky joins us now to talk about this at least biannual matchup and why it inflames such intense interest. Thanks for joining us, Art Chansky.
Well, thank you for having me. It's fun.
Yeah, and we welcome your calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. Are you a fan of Coach K or Roy Williams or still Dean Smith? What about the coaches or players resonates with you? Do you have a personal story about it, or does all of this hoopla just escape you? Give us a call. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. So, Art Chansky, why is the rivalry so intense?
It's interesting. It's a case of closeness and opposites attract, I think. Closeness, obviously, 8 miles. The intensity, there's a lot of sharing going on between the two universities, as you mentioned, also between the student bodies. You know, there's a lot of partying going on Franklin Street and now on 9th Street, too, that 9th Street has come so far. But also there's opposites, too, because it's a private school and a public school. It's big versus small. It is a student body mainly from North Carolina and a student body mainly from outside of North Carolina. And so I think those opposites are very attractive for a rivalry. And then when you have it 8 miles apart and when you have two basketball programs that have been as successful over an extended period of time, and I say way before Roy Williams and even Dean Smith back to Frank McGuire, and of course before Coach K to Bill Foster and Vic Bubas, that sustained rivalry and excellence has kept it going. And, you know, Melinda, when one of the teams has a blip and is not very good, the other school doesn't like it. They want the rivalry to get back to where it's tooth and nail at every game.
Mm. So, and these programs have been incredibly successful. I mean, I was reading in your book, just as a reminder, that, you know, in the past 20 years, 5 national titles. That accounts for Duke or Carolina having a quarter of the national championships in that 20-year period. That's pretty phenomenal.
Well, yeah, what's more amazing than that is that only 2 or 3 years in an extended period of time have neither Duke nor North Carolina been in the Final Four. And, you know, Duke's run in the 90s was amazing, and it overshadowed Carolinas, who didn't go every year, but they went just about every other year. And the years that they weren't there, Duke was there. And, of course, in 1991, they were both there.
Our number is 1-877-962-9862 if you want to join the conversation. We're talking about the rivalry between Carolina and Duke with Art Chansky. He's author of Blue Blood. 1-877-962-9862. And in those, explain to me why. Because I have heard many people say locally, maybe there's equal numbers, that, you know, if Carolina gets into the Final Four and Duke doesn't, you know, the fans of one team would not root for the other team, even if it is the local team that's in the national championship.
I would say that that's by and large true because the rivalry is so intense. It sort of goes back to the old days of the Brooklyn Dodgers, the New York Giants, and the Yankees in New York, where if you were a fan of one of those teams, you didn't root for the other two. They were more level-headed, more mature fans, many of them who have migrated to this area who just love the competition. You almost have to pick an allegiance when you get here. The peer pressure is too great when you move into a neighborhood and 10 of your neighbors are a fan of one school. It's easy to get sucked up into that. And if your young child goes to school the first day, and 20 kids in his class are wearing Carolina T-shirts, you know. But a lot of times, those families that come maintain a maturity that, even though they pull for one school, they like to see, you know, college basketball, local teams be successful. And so they will root. But I think, by and large, once the rivalry grabs you and bites you, it's hard to root for the other team to be as successful, because basically you're being left out.
Right, right. I mean, Dukies learn the ABCs pretty quickly, anybody but Carolina, don't they?
Right.
Well, but the thing is that other sports between those schools don't seem to have the same intensity of the rivalry.
It doesn't.
So what is it about basketball?
Well, it goes back to, and we cover it a little bit pre-ACC and pre-1950s in this book, when it was much more intensely a football rivalry, because football was a bigger game in the South at that point. Wallace Wade was the coach that Duke recruited away from Alabama to build its football program. And the Duke-Carolina football rivalry was as intense in those days as basketball is now. NC State, ironically, never thought it could compete with Duke and Carolina in football, so they hired a man named Everett Case from Indiana to build its basketball program. And they thought, well, if we can't match Duke and Carolina in football, we'll have a better basketball program. Well, State's program was so successful that Carolina didn't like losing to Everett Case in the winter, and they hired Frank McGuire from St. John's, who had been to Chapel Hill and flight school in the 1940s. His team, St. John's, had just lost the 1952 national championship to a team, Kansas, a team that had a reserve guard named Dean Smith. So when Tom Scott, the UNC coach, was not very successful in his last few years in the old Southern Conference, Carolina went to New York and hired Frank McGuire. And Frank had an ill son, Frankie, who was an invalid, and he wanted to move out of New York City to a better environment where he could drive 5 minutes from his office and go visit young Frankie for lunch every day, where you can't do that, obviously, in New York City. So they were lucky. They hired Frank McGuire, and he beat Everett Case in his first game. And then Duke was watching all of this, the State-Carolina rivalry, and they decided they needed a coach to compete with it, and they went and they plucked Vic Bubas away from Everett Case's staff. And that, so, you know, hoping that Duke could compete with State and Carolina.
Now, this is all in the 1950s.
In the 1950s, in the mid-1950s, and Duke hired Vic Bubas in 1959. Now, the interesting thing, it all turned over a young man named Art Heyman, who was a great player in Oceanside High School on Long Island. And a lot of the New York kids came to North Carolina on Frank McGuire's Underground Railroad, his mythical recruiting train. And Heyman fell in line, and he signed with Carolina a scholarship. And he was supposed to come down and play with another kid from Long Island, one of his rivals named Larry Brown, whose name is familiar because he's now been the successful yet nomadic coach of 7 or 8 NBA teams. So they both were headed down here, and in those days, the scholarship you signed in the ACC wasn't binding until July 1st. So.
And when is it binding now?
It's binding as soon as you sign it now.
Okay.
When they have
because it's much bigger business.
Exactly.
Yeah.
When the national signing date comes, you sign it, you're there, and it's heavy penalty if you change. But Vic Bubas was hired in early May by Duke. He knew that there was some discontent between Art Heyman's stepfather, Bill Heyman, and Frank McGuire. They were kind of same personality. They rubbed each other the wrong way. So Bubas went after Heyman. He went to New York. He started recruiting him. He started wooing the family. And after Frank McGuire and Bill Heyman, Art's stepfather, almost had a fist fight at the University Motel one evening when Art came down for pre-orientation, they decided that Art was going to Duke instead. Now imagine today that happening. Imagine a J.J. Redick or somebody like that who had signed and was expected to play at either Duke or Carolina, and on the very day or the very week he shows up at the other school. Hmm. And so how that festered. And you know, Melinda, back then they didn't have, they had freshman ineligibility, which means they had freshman teams. So Art Heyman's freshman team at Duke had to play Larry Brown's freshman team at Duke. And that rivalry festered until for a whole year until they could get together on the varsity
And these
court.
Are two guys who had been rivals up in on Long Island.
Big time rivals, right.
So and you're saying that is the recruitment of that one kid, and he was a kid then, 18 years old, Heyman, that got this Duke-Carolina rivalry, that basketball, it was Everett Case at NC State who thought basketball would be the way to go to make a stand for state, but then he seemed to have been bypassed once this Duke-Carolina rivalry came.
Well, so the first part of the story is that Heyman defects from Carolina and ends up at Duke, and then in the very first game that they played on one of the other's home court, they had played their sophomore year in the Dixie Classic, where Heyman didn't have a very good game. But on February 4th, 1961, when he was a sophomore and Larry Brown was a sophomore, they played at Duke. And a very famous brawl erupted at the end of that game with about a minute to play in a very close game. About 50, 60 people, fans, were on the court fighting. It took about 15 minutes to break that thing up. And from then, and because that game was regionally televised and there was a snowstorm that blanketed much of the southeast, so a lot of people were having cabin fever watching that game. And from that moment on, Melinda, it became a basketball rivalry, a fierce one. And Frank McGuire, that was his last year. He stepped down and took Dean Smith a year or two to build the Carolina program up. But during that time, Heyman was still at Duke because he was only a sophomore when this fight started. And so the rivalry maintained there, and of course it took Dean a couple of years to build his program. But once he did, he got his program on the same level with Vic Bubas, and you know it's gone on from there, very, very competitively, very evenly, you know, and very colorfully too, because there are many, many more players like Art Heyman and Larry Brown who have gone to both schools that were the object of both coaches' recruiting attention.
Yeah. Now, Dean Smith had been an assistant coach under Frank McGuire, and then he becomes the coach. Was it 1961 or so?
1961.
And as you say, he had a couple of losing seasons. Was it three losing seasons?
No, he had one.
One? Okay.
But he had non-winning seasons or mediocre seasons for his standard. But when he took over, he was handcuffed because it was also the days, dark days in college basketball. It was a gambling scandal, the second one that occurred in college basketball. The first was in the early 50s in New York. The second one was in the late 50s and early 60s, and it really centered around this Dixie Classic, which was an eight-team tournament that Everett Case had started at the old Reynolds Coliseum. And it was a place where gangsters hung out, and they bribed kids not to throw games but just not to win by as many points as they were favored to win by, you know, the old cover-the-spread thing. And Bill Friday was the president of the Consolidated University of North Carolina at that time, and he thought that the gambling scandals were correctly so, a real threat and a blight to college basketball. He wanted them to end, and he abolished the Dixie Classic because that was a breeding ground for gangsters and people, unsavory characters who would come down. Actually, some of them were packing pistols at that time and threatening these young kids. So he ended the Dixie Classic, and he also cut the recruiting for NC State and Carolina. He limited the number of recruits they could sign from outside of the ACC area, the number of recruits in general, and cut the schedules for both teams. Now, Everett Case had been at State for a long time, and his legend was already ingrained, so such sanctions didn't hurt him as much as his young Dean Smith, who no one really knew, who took over for the flamboyant and colorful Frank McGuire. So it really hurt Carolina's recruiting much more than State, and it put Carolina in a position where it took a couple of years before they could start recruiting the quality players to compete with Duke.
Mm-hmm. Now, in those days, the early 60s, when Dean Smith and the coach at Duke would be, and at State, would be recruiting players, they were recruiting white players exclusively. His sure. Integration had not yet happened. It had happened in college teams in the North.
Correct.
But this is, we shall remember, this was the South. Right. And so Dean Smith is, however, given a lot of credit for changing that.
He was, and he... there's a little anecdote in the book where Eli Evans, who's from Durham, his father was Mud Evans, the longtime mayor of Durham, and Eli is an accomplished author and visits often. He was the president of the student body at Carolina. He went to Frank McGuire in 1958 as a sophomore or a junior, and he said, you know, we should integrate our basketball program. And McGuire said, I agree with you. I tried to recruit this player named Wilt Chamberlain out of Philadelphia, but the ACC had a Byzantine 800 SAT minimum for student athletes, and Wilt didn't have that. Dean Smith always thought that that was a tremendously culturally biased standard. So when Dean took over, his first goal was to integrate Carolina basketball with a student athlete, and he tried with a player named Lou Hudson from Greensboro, who didn't have the 800. He tried with another one named Herm Gilliam from Winston-Salem, who didn't have the 800. He actually had a young man in his program as a walk-on freshman and was ready to give him a scholarship, but this kid was more interested in academics and he wanted to concentrate. So it wasn't until the mid-1960s when he heard about this New Yorker named Charlie Scott, who had come down to go to prep school at Laurinburg. And Bill Curry, the old voice of the Tar Heels, heard about it and said, you got to look at this kid. He's made a verbal non-binding commitment to Lefty Driesell at Davidson, but we hear there's trouble in Davidson because of the way some of the people from Laurinburg were treated when the visits occurred. So Dean sent Larry Brown, his assistant coach at that time, to see Charlie Scott on the way back from a visit to Rick Mount in Lebanon, Indiana. Rick Mount was considered the number one high school player in the country. His picture was in Sports Illustrated. And Larry Brown, on the way back, flew into Charlotte, got a rental car, drove to Laurinburg Institute, and what he saw... There were no cell phones, of course, in those days. He was so excited he couldn't even wait to make the 90-minute drive back to Chapel Hill. He had to get to a payphone and call Dean Smith and say, he's better than Rick Mount. The kid I saw is better than Rick Mount. And Dean Smith said, no, he can't be. And Larry said, he's better than Rick Mount. And they also found out that because of the way the Laurinburg coaches were treated in a, I guess, a sort of semi-integrated restaurant in Davidson.
These would have been black coaches?
Yes, yeah. Frank McDuffie was the coach, and he was taken to a restaurant and treated very rudely when he was taken there by Terry Holland, who was Driesell's assistant at Davidson. And Charlie started to have second thoughts, and Dean invited him to for a recruiting visit in Chapel Hill on a beautiful spring weekend. We used to have something called Jubilee at Carolina, where Smokey Robinson and the Miracles were playing. And he introduced him to Howard Lee, who would become the first black mayor of Chapel Hill, and took him to his integrated Baptist church. And Charlie was much more comfortable about that. So he went back to Laurinburg and decided that Carolina, even though he really liked Lefty Driesell, Carolina would be a better place, you know, for him to be the pioneer. And he gave the bad news to Lefty.
And this was what year that Carolina finally got integrated?
1965.
And Dean Smith's father had some kind of history doing this. He was a high school basketball coach in Kansas. And
no question.
Had Alfred, done something along those same lines.
Alfred Smith was told by the Kansas High School Athletic Association to drop a fellow named Paul Terry off of his team. And he refused. He said, you can fire me. I'm not doing it. You know. And he was a very successful, almost legendary high school coach in Kansas. And he refused. And he kept Terry on the team. And he was one of the pioneers of that as well. And I think Dean knew that story. He grew up as a liberal Democrat and very, as you know, involved in a lot of activities off the court. And I think that made a great impression on him.
How about Duke had more difficult time or a slower time of integrating?
It did. And because, and Vic Bubas realized it, this Doug Knight was the president at the time at Duke. There was a movement by a faction at Duke to de-emphasize athletics and really turn Duke into an Ivy League type school, which it really hadn't been. It had been a fine university, but it hadn't been of the academic standing it is today. And when that happened, of course, it was harder to integrate a program and recruit black basketball players because there wasn't a diversity of programs in which they could. And the other side of the coin was even the most qualified ones were being told by rival recruiters, "Don't go to Duke. You'll flunk out. You're not doing your race any good. You won't set the right example there." They were really using It was racist on their part. They were using their race against them. And I think when Dean Smith, when Vic Bubas realized that, he realized that not because Dean Smith was being successful, it was because he couldn't keep up in that respect, and he decided to retire in 1969.
We'll continue our conversation with Art Shansky. His new book is called Blue Blood, Duke, Carolina, Inside the Most Storied Rivalry in College Hoops. More of the history of the Duke-Carolina rivalry and your calls at 1-877-962-9862 on the State of Things. This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava. There are a few exhibition games this week in college men's basketball. Duke against Concordia College, UNC against Fayetteville State. These games, of course, don't count in the standings. And for some fans, the only games in the regular season that really matter are the matchups between Carolina and Duke. That would be on February 7th and March 4th. The buildup for these Carolina-Duke games will be immense. Duke students will spend months camping out in Krzyzewskiville, the temporary camp set up each season outside Cameron Indoor Stadium, where students line up in tents for the best seats for the Carolina game. And the national media will descend on the Triangle for the games, which every year draw the largest ratings for any regular season televised games. And so, on the eve of beginning the regular season, we're talking this hour about the men's basketball rivalry between Carolina and Duke. Art Shansky is here. He is author of the new book, Blue Blood, Duke, Carolina, Inside the Most Storied Rivalry in College Hoops. And we're taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. Well, we were talking about, just before the break, about Carolina integrating its team with Dean Smith in the mid-1960s, and Duke being a little slower to do so. I want to move forward, though, and talk about what had been a longtime rivalry until Dean Smith retired between Mike Krzyzewski at Duke and Dean Smith. A lot of similarities between the two, but also great differences.
Very much so. And I think when Mike Krzyzewski came to Duke, he was a very unknown coach. He came from Army, had a losing record in his last season. It was a big gamble for Duke, and one that a lot of people thought was financially based because Duke was struggling financially back then. His opening salary was $48,000. Now, Dean Smith's opening salary in 1961 was $9,500.
I think it's telling in your book, though, that Mike Krzyzewski accepted the job at Duke without having worked out the details.
Exactly. He called his wife and said, "I got the job." And she said, "What's your salary?" He said, "I don't know. I didn't ask." And she said, "You didn't ask." But he knew that Tom Butters would be fair, and Tom Butters had gone to Bob Knight. Tom Butters grew up in Ohio in the same hometown as Bob Knight, the coach in Indiana, and when he was looking for a coach to succeed Bill Foster, who had been successful in his last 3 years at Duke but then moved on, he called Knight and wanted somebody who coached defense like Knight did. He even asked Knight to take the job, and of course Knight wouldn't, but he did recommend three of his assistants, and one of them was Mike Krzyzewski, who was the least known of the three that he recommended at Army. But there was something about Krzyzewski that Butters liked, that he kept inviting him back for interview after interview. It was a big gamble. He knew it. He was coming off a losing season at Army. His assistant athletic director, Steve Ascendek, said, "Are you going to hire him, or are you just going to interview him forever?" And Butters couldn't get Krzyzewski out of his mind. And finally, he did hire him. It was a tremendous gamble. There was a lot of heat the first few years. But I think in those days, Melinda, Mike Krzyzewski, being 8 miles from the Duke program, looked at Dean Smith's program, and he said, "They do some things better than anybody. I want to emulate that program in some ways. But there are some things that I would do differently, and I'm going to do them differently." And I think that really points out how Mike Krzyzewski has set his own path at Duke. And
what did he do differently?
Well, he believed in a different kind of basketball. He believed Dean Smith was more regimented. He numbered his plays by position. Mike favored just putting the five best athletes out there. He favored really more effort over execution. And he didn't want so much to rest on what happened between Duke and Carolina in the regular season. His goal was to be the best team nationally. So he really changed that paradigm as we went along. And now really it is. I mean, Duke can beat Carolina twice during the regular season, but if Carolina goes further in the NCAA tournament, then it's considered the Tar Heels had a better season. And I think that's the standard that Mike helped change. Of course, NCAA tournament has gotten so big now that's helped it along. But he has built a program in his own image. We joked during the break that he's never been to Franklin Street, and that sort of...
It's 25 years in the area, never been to Franklin
Street. He sort of personifies, that separateness that he has created for his Duke program.
Now, conversely, has Dean Smith ever been to 9th Street in Durham?
Yeah, I don't know that for a fact, but I'm sure he has. You know why? Because there are excellent restaurants on 9th Street, and Dean Smith always finds the best restaurants.
Well, of course, they started out with rather humble salaries, but both men, Dean Smith when he was coaching and Coach K now, they're pulling down pretty hefty salaries.
They are. You know, Mike Krzyzewski makes about 40 times his opening salary, and because Duke is a private school and won't and doesn't have to release those figures, but his annual income is estimated at around $2 million. You know, including a lot of off-the-court things like the American Express, the American Express commercials, and then this deal with XM Radio. He just began, so he really is a remarkable guy. Roy Williams at Carolina is a pure basketball coach. He really is not interested in much more than coaching basketball. Mike Krzyzewski is really what I call a sideline CEO. I mean, he and Duke have set the example of how to run a college athletic program in the 21st century. He doesn't want to just quit coaching and go to the TV booth. He wants to continue to make a statement, to have a platform. And that's why the Coach K Fuqua School of Ethics, the leadership conference that he has, the great fantasy camp that he has to bring a lot of corporate leaders back. He wants to he wants to be known as more than a basketball coach. And the fact that he's now been named the USA coach for the Olympics, I think, is something that has also broadened his entire image.
Of course, the NBA came courting, but he wasn't wooed ultimately last summer.
No, he wasn't.
To coach the Lakers. And nor had Dean Smith ever jumped to the NBA. Why do you think they both stuck with college basketball?
Well, I think that they consider themselves teachers. And as the salaries have escalated in the NBA, it's more difficult to be teachers. It's more difficult to talk to 18 and 19-year-olds who are making 10 times the money that you are and see no reason to listen to anybody. It goes back to their upbringing and a lot of things that coaches have no control over these days. And Dean Smith always liked the college campus. Mike Krzyzewski has renewed his commitment to Duke 3 or 4 times, and he's enjoyed that because it has always allowed him not to take for granted what he has at Duke. And he really has a fabulous program at a great university. And I'm not sure he could have. It's such a great marriage, Krzyzewski and Duke, that I'm not sure he could have done that at another school.
Mm. I want to talk a little bit more about those two coaches, Coach Krzyzewski and Dean Smith, off the court. Some places where they are different is in politics.
No question, yeah. It was funny that Dean Smith doesn't wear it on his sleeve, but he's always been a Democrat and, as we said, stood out for liberal causes. He was one of the first people to help integrate a restaurant in Chapel Hill, and we write about it in the book, in the Pines Restaurant, when he was an assistant coach. He took a black theology student and his minister, Robert Seymour, into the Pines, where the team ate a lot of its pregame meals, and they were served. And from that point forward, the Pines did serve minorities. But someone said, you know, it really didn't happen until the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Well, the truth is that any blacks who went in after that were served. But it wasn't just because Dean Smith and the theology student were served that, you know, they were all of a sudden coming there in groups. They still wanted to go someplace where they felt they were accepted and comfortable. And so it evolved over the years, and it really didn't until the mid-60s. And, you know, since then, Dean has been, the nuclear freeze, the death penalty have been some of his causes. Mike Krzyzewski, until he won that first national championship, and went to, actually, I think it was the second, because it was in March of, or April of 1992. He was there with George Herbert Walker Bush, and the election was coming up, and he had just won back-to-back championships, and he said to President Bush, "I hope we're both back here next year." Mm. And that was the first real public statement of his political leanings. And since then, he's been involved and been criticized a couple of times for, you know, for he and former player Mike Jaminski and his wife and some other folks at Duke hosting Republican fundraisers. And so neither coach really flaunts it, but it's clear where they both stand.
So what's the future of this rivalry?
Well, Mike says it. He says it, it's not him versus Roy. It's not him versus Dean. It wasn't Dean versus Vic Bubas. This rivalry, they are the primary caretakers, but they are still caretakers to the rivalry. And Carolina had a blip. They hired the wrong man in Matt Doherty. They rectified that by bringing Roy Williams back. You know, Roy's 55, Mike's 58. Neither of them are going for a very long time. But I think the rivalry, what they've done and their predecessors have done, the rivalry will go on forever. Both coaches will have a heavy hand in making sure that their successes maintain the rivalry.
There's a lot of competition out there on the court outside of that short distance between Chapel Hill and Durham and Duke and Carolina. How important is it for both schools to compete nationally and at the same time have clean basketball programs where academics is not just shunted aside?
It's part of the image. You know, Duke has tried to make it, I think, more part of the image than Carolina has. And part of their mantra is it's Duke isn't for everyone. It's for the special kid. And I think that in basketball, you can get away with that. You can't get away with it in football because the numbers are too big, as Duke has proven. But in basketball, there's a select group of first-class players, Class A players, and a percentage of them are academically qualified. And Duke, having the great exposure that they've had, the great success that they've had, now has a chance to get every one of those players. It would be very and they don't get every one of them, but they get their share. It would be very difficult for a school to set that standard up and not be as successful at Duke because they couldn't get enough players to sustain it.
Okay. Art Chansky, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Art Chansky is the author of Blue Blood, Duke, Carolina, Inside the Most Storied Rivalry in College Hoops.